Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I'm your host, Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Callie Grace Thomas.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask what got them started writing.
And what keeps them going.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
Then we ask for advice that we, and you, our listeners, can use in our own writing practices.
Without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast. Hello, Poetry Salon listeners. Thank you for tuning in. Today, I am super excited because we are going to be interviewing one of my favorite poets and poetry mentors, Kim Adonizio. I met Kim Adonizio a while ago when I was still just a new poet and wanting someone to study with. And a friend of mine had heard her speak at one of the colleges in the Bay Area and told me I should look her up. And I did. I started taking classes with Kim at her house in Oakland. And I have since told pretty much every poet I know. She's one of the wisest poetry editors I've ever met or worked with. And so I am super excited to introduce the one and only Kim Adonizio. Kim, welcome, and thank you for coming to the podcast.
Thanks, Tricia. Glad to be here.
And would you start us off by just reading two of your poems that you want to discuss?
I will. These are both from my next book, which is coming out from Norton in 2021. The book is called Now We're Getting Somewhere. So these are two poems from that book. This is Night in the Castle. I'm not sure what to do about that scorpion twitching on the wall. Maybe I should slam it with this book of terrible poetry, or just read aloud to it until it dies of a histrionic metaphor, bleeding out on the ancient stones in a 5-octave aria. If I get a little drunker, I might try to murder it with my sandal. I gave up on mercy a while ago. That's what happens when you live in a castle on an artist's grant. You look at the late afternoon Umbrian light smearing itself over the tomato vines and feel entitled, like an underage duchess whose husband has finally died of gout, leaving her free for more secret liaisons with the court musician. She might even have poisoned the duke, the lecherous shit. It's hard to remember what life was like before this, and I don't want to. I want to stay here and poison the king next. I want to be a feared and beloved queen, ordering up fresh linens and beheadings, locking up bad poets in their artisanal hair shirts, torturing academics with pornographic marionette performances. Meanwhile, the scorpion is still there, twitching blackly, reciting something about violence in the prison of ego. And I can hear the clashing armies on the wide lawn outside, sinking down into history and then standing up again. And the other one I'm going to read is a 14-line, I call this form a sonnety thing. It's also a monorhyme poem. This is High Desert, New Mexico. Temple of the rattlesnake's religion, deluge and heat surge, crush of the atom's rupture. Night blackens like a violin, and bright flower falls from the kitchens of heaven. This is where the seams begin to loosen, where you can walk for miles in any direction. Rabbit, lizard, raven, insect, drone, and almost forget the shame of being human. Smoke tree, sage, not everything is broken. Horses appear at this remote cabin to stand outside and wait for you to come with a single apple. Abandon your despair, you who enter here forsaken. The wind is saying something. Listen.
Thank you so much, Kim. I am so excited about this new book.
So am I. I have to say, I think it's pretty kick-ass.
Yeah, I think so too, from the two-poem preview.
I'm really, really happy with how this one came together and turned out.
From the moment that scorpion appeared and you wanted to smash it with your shoe, I was just like, I am in a Kim Adonizio poem, no doubt about it. I wish there were another term, but the only one I know is ballsy. The ballsiness of it. I wish there were a female-centric one.
There's no anatomical female part that quite has that ring, does it?
A little, maybe a little hint of moxie. Some of that, like, come here, let me tell you something, attitude about it. And I love that sass on a throne, that it's more regal than just middle school sass. I have a question, Kim. You said that this collection you thought came together really, really well. You're such an accomplished poet. You have so many amazing books on craft and helping. I mean, I read Ordinary Genius many years back, and it was such a companion to me, and it helped me a lot. I'm wondering how the different personalities of different collections feel and how you might have shifted over time.
Yeah, they do shift a lot from book to book, and I want them to shift from book to book. You know, I don't really want to do the same thing over and over, although there's clear obsessions and threads running through from the beginning, which I think is true of every writer. But I do sort of think about how can I not do what I've done before, or maybe take further at least what I've done before. When I started out, part of it is just who you fall under the spell of. And so when I'm under the spell of one writer, I'm trying to learn from them. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to see what they're up to and reverse engineer it and figure things out. And, you know, so early on, one of my early teachers was C.D. Wright. Mm-hmm. And this was at the time that she introduced me to Frank Stanford, and her early work was very much like Frank Stanford's. So my early work was my imitation and my attempt to write like Frank Stanford and C.D. Wright. C.D. went on, of course, to develop as an amazing writer in different ways than she started out. But that very plain, straightforward narrative, a man sits in the dark listening to the rain, that's not a line, but it probably could be from that kind of time. My writing then was pretty plain and pretty spare and very earnest. And so those are some of the things that have changed. For a long time, I despaired of ever knowing how to really make metaphorical leaps. And that was the hard thing for me, was to sort of break out of that plain style. But eventually I did, you know, eventually I just started reading other people. And so then Sharon Olds was a big influence. So that helped crack open my ability to write similes and metaphors. That was a big help with figurative language, as well as just permission to say anything. She was the one who I felt gave me permission in poetry. And then I was also reading a lot of people like Kathy Acker and William Burroughs and George Bataille and the writers, Jean Genet, you know, all the writers that were challenging prose in other ways. And so that was sort of an influence too. And then just continuing to encounter different writers and sort of finding something exciting about their work and trying to do my own version and trying to figure out what they were up to that I really responded to, and then how to make that my own.
Kim, one of the things that I so enjoy about working with you, and that really helped me when I was a young writer, I love the fact that you will be open and honest about your struggles in writing sometime. I remember when I was taking class with you going like, Kim's never had a poem rejected. She's probably like, all of her work comes out perfect. So to hear these stories about this book that you're struggling with, or that thing that you're struggling, or that it took you a while to feel confident and comfortable with metaphor, do you feel like there's a kind of voice of yours that isn't so much influenced by other people? But I guess, are there times when you avoid the influence of other people and work without influence?
Well, influence is such a tricky word because it happens in so many ways. When you're reading something, things go in that you're not aware of at the time. And I really think it is sort of that garbage in, garbage out. But it doesn't even need to be garbage. It could just be a writer who triggers you in the wrong way. So if you're reading someone and then you sort of, that stuff is going in somewhere, the way they make sentences, the subject matter, the rhythms, you may not even be aware of it. If you're really that kind of osmotic writer where things just filter in, sometimes you have to be careful who you read. Like I remember with my fiction, when I was reading Ray Carver, and then I would try to write a story, it was just horrific. And I could not read Ray Carver any time near my writing time. And, or in fact, you know, maybe like a month or two Where if I had been reading any Ray Carver, I would start to write these awful sentences. So for me, that was one writer who was not very helpful.
And for those who haven't read a lot of Raymond Carver, could you maybe say in a couple sentences what doesn't work about him for you?
Wow, yeah, that's so funny. That really dates me because anyone who might now need to be acquainted or reacquainted with Raymond Carver is very surprising to me. But he was big in the 80s. So of course, you know, the 80s were sort of this big heyday of resurgence of people reading short stories where they became very much an important form again. Carver actually was heavily edited by his editor, Gordon Lish. So it's hard to say really how Ray Carver wrote. I think they subsequently came out with some stories that were not the ones edited by Lish or after he had broken free of a certain style that, from what I remember reading vaguely years ago, that Lish just had a lot to do with making his writing very pared down, tightened down, concise in a way that it wasn't necessarily before that editing. And so that's what I was trying to do. It was somewhat like akin to what I was doing in poetry, which was sparer, flatter sentences. But I didn't have Carver's genius of writing those sentences in a way that really illuminated characters and situations in such an amazing way. So I kind of aped one aspect of his style, but that was not a style that suited me. And that's what I think you have to be wary of. And then as far as what you do on your own, I mean, everything becomes a synthesis of everything else, just like we're products of our culture in so many ways. To some extent, we're products of our reading as writers. And I think the more that you read and the more that you explore different ways of writing and thinking, the more of your own writer you become. But it's also, you are a part of that whole stream of writing and you're synthesizing all the things you've picked up from those various styles and those ways of thinking. And of course, it's not just writing. It's also the things that you're thinking about. It's the people that you run into. It's the art that you're looking at. It's the theater that you're going to. It's like all of culture. It's popular culture. It's the TV shows you're watching. All of those things become influences, I think.
There's kind of no way of escaping that influence. I guess that does make it extremely important what it is that you're reading, that you're reading the people that are going to lead you to your best voice, I guess.
Yeah, I think that reading is an act of revealing. So it reveals not only the world around you, but it reveals what you like and what you want to dismantle, whether it's inside yourself or in terms of craft, and also like what turns you off. I am also a student of Kim's. So it's really awesome that Tricia recommended Kim a long time ago. And she was like, if you ever get to the Bay Area, and now I find myself living here. So I was fortunate enough that there was an opening. I think I replied to the email in like 3 minutes. I was like, please, please let me in, please. But one of the things, Kim, that I love, love, love about your class is that not only are you a fantastic editor and mentor, but you have such a wide knowledge of reading and other poets and other authors. And I think that this is something that we rarely talk about as writers and poets, and I wish we talked about more. Can you talk a little bit about your reading discipline, about the schedule, like how you set yourself up to be a reader as much as a writer?
I don't actually think my knowledge is that wide or deep. I've been writing long enough that I've encountered a lot more. I think it was, who was it that said it? Somebody like Gore Vidal, this writer who won't be named, once wrote, I have all the deficiencies of the autodidact. Mm. And so he, you know, self-taught. And that's very true of me. I mean, I did go to graduate school, but I didn't go to undergrad in English. So I missed a lot. And then when I got to grad school, I certainly learned a lot. I feel like most of my learning has been sort of my own exploration. Mm. I got a good start in a master's program, a good knowledge of what I should be reading or directions to follow. You know, I think grad school is kind of a map for here's your life's work now. You're not really anything yet. You know, you're not really minted as a writer. you've been shown the map, and then if you're going to become a writer, really become a writer, you need to begin to follow the map and map your own territory as well.
What was your undergrad degree in?
Well, I started out in music back in DC for 2.5 years, studying classical voice, and I thought I might somehow do some kind of music education. But then when I was around 27 or so, I discovered poetry. And that changed everything. And I was, as the Brits say, gobsmacked.
How did you discover it?
Well, as far as I remember, it was some Sylvia Plath. I have a really clear memory of where I was at the time, but not exactly what I was reading. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know anything about poetry. You know, I'd gone to Walt Whitman High School, and I, you know, the way you don't register names, you never think about who that street's named after. So Walt Whitman High School, never really thought anything of it. It was just like Whitman beat Gonzaga, beat BBC, the other schools in Bethesda, and it never occurred to me that this was a poet who had written, of course, one of the great American poems. And I remember memorizing Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach when I was in high school, because I read a fragment in a book. Seemed to lay before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new. Hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms, a struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. While I memorized it in high school, I can still mostly recite it, but that ending also informs the ending of Night in the Castle.
Oh, wow.
The armies lying down and getting back up. That comes from my knowledge of the Matthew Arnold poem, or I wouldn't have been able to write that ending.
Right.
So there's another kind of influence, right? But I think that was it. It was that little bit in high school. I was in journalism. I liked to write and I liked English. I think we wrote haikus. But I didn't really know anything. So when I started to become interested in poetry, I would go to the bookstore and look for covers that I liked because I didn't know who to read. And I would buy books based on their covers. You know. It's okay, I went to grad school because that's kind of a slow way to learn.
Man, it sounds like a good method to me when you're younger, you know?
Absolutely. It was great to just discover. That's how I discovered Denise Levertov. First book I read was Life in the Forest with a transparent woman on the cover.
Mm. And I think that says a lot about the importance of selecting the right cover art, too. You know, if you're picturing a young writer coming upon your book, what do you want them to know about it based solely on the cover that they're looking at?
It's huge. It's huge. I just went through a big fight with my publisher. Not a big fight, but let's just say goodwill was lessened on both sides. Because the first iterations of the cover they gave me, I thought, were completely in the wrong direction. The second iterations, I felt, weren't much better. And by that time, everyone was pretty testy. But I'm really happy with how the cover turned out, and I think it does convey something about the book that is true to the contents inside it.
I feel like, for me, knowing your writing as I do, and I know you play blues harmonica, so I guess it doesn't surprise me too much that your first impulse was towards music, and of course, music. I know there's a line of poetry that just says something like, I would be making music with my words. I'm curious to know a little bit more about your day-to-day writing process. Is there a specific structure that you have to it, or is it when the muse strikes, or can you talk a little bit about the genesis of a poem?
Yeah, as far as schedule, I don't really have one right now. I have had schedules at various times of my life, and they've changed depending on my life. It always changes, and sometimes it's more random and sometimes it's more disciplined. But the process, when you said that we would be talking about a poem that was easy to write and a poem that's hard, my first thought is mostly if it's easy, it turns out badly. Because it's never easy. So it usually takes a lot of work to get it to something more interesting. And sometimes being able to write at all makes it feel easy. You know, when there are those vast stretches where you can't write, then suddenly feeling like you've kind of hit the energy stream again feels amazing and feels easy because you're suddenly writing again.
Yeah, I will admit I'm in one of those stretches. I think the way you put it, you're out of the energy stream and then you're in the energy stream again. So I'm curious about the specific poems you read at the top of the interview. Now I want to know which one of them was the one that came more easily.
Yeah, it was High Desert, New Mexico was a bit easier. What happened was that I was in one of those stretches of not writing for a long time. I'd gone to New Mexico as a presenter for a BBC radio show on the Lightning Field, which is a land art installation by Walter de Maria, which consists of a bunch of steel poles in an empty field in the middle of the high desert in New Mexico, and one of the places where lightning frequently strikes, although the purpose of going to the lightning field is not actually to see lightning. But I went with this producer and we went there to do a show. So part of it was staying overnight at this remote cabin with no internet, no phone, except for an emergency line to call the guy who drove us out to the middle of nowhere. The other interesting thing about it was there was no photography allowed and also no recording allowed. So here we'd come to make a radio show on the lightning field. We weren't allowed to record at the actual lightning field. So we had to go into radio silence once we got there and just have the experience we had leading up the trip to the lightning field and then afterwards talking about what had happened in our time there. And they leave you there overnight. They give you all the fixings for dinner. We brought the fixings for margaritas. Like, I think there were four or five of us. You know, we were there in this cabin in the middle of nowhere, just sitting there in the desert silence, looking at the sky and at the light changing on these poles as the sun went down, walking the lightning field at dusk and then in the morning, you know, before we got picked up. And that was part of the experience. Coming home from that trip, I was asked to write something for the show. So I ended up writing that poem, High Desert, New Mexico. And so after this time of not writing at all, I'd had really a quite amazing, sublime experience. And so the poem did pretty much flow, although it certainly went through a number of tweaks and revisions. So one thing that helps write is having an assignment of some kind. I know my students say, well, I wouldn't be writing except that I'm taking this workshop. And I give them suggestions for writing as a way to sort of get them going. So here I had my own prompt. And also the fact that this was going to be on the radio, not only was I going to be presenting the show, but a piece of my writing was going to be on the show. So that, of course, made me sit down to try to come up with something. Having an assignment or a prompt, I've often written things when somebody's working on an anthology and they say, hey, do you have an essay about motherhood or do you have a poem about X? And I don't, but I'll sit down and try to write something because someone's asking. And that's really helpful. The other thing that helped with this poem that really made it crystallize was the help of the mono rhymes. And I'd always wanted to write a mono rhyme poem. That is, every word at the end of the line rhymes with every other word. Rhyme not in the moon, June sense necessarily, but all the other kinds of rhyme that are available to you, like slant rhyme and assonance. I wanted to write a mono rhyme poem. And so the language of each line helped lead me to the next line. So when I had the first line, which was Temple of the Rattlesnake's Religion. And then, of course, we were near Alamogordo, where the atom bomb was developed. So atom is close enough to religion and sound. That made a nice ending word. And it went on from there. So both the formal element, the formal principle of it, and the fact that it was kind of a prompt that was given me were really the things. Because I think when you start from language and you let that guide where you're going next, some kind of formal element, some limit gets your imagination working right away. And even if you're not aware of it, your subconscious mind keeps mulling over the problem. And so I like form as a way to really develop a piece. It's really all about patterning. All poetry is about patterning. So it could be a more rigid pattern or it could be a looser pattern, but paying attention to the patterning, which is part of the music, is one thing that helps me write the poem.
I have a question about patterns that's not about form. I know all poets have their obsessions, and I'm wondering what are some of yours that you have chased and toyed with over the years?
I think they've pretty much never changed. One is just mortal life. One is mortality, so being in a body that's going to age and die. Mm. I hope that's the good news, right? aging is the good news, because what's the alternative? So that's always been a concern. Romantic love, and love in all its forms, and the challenges and struggles with that. And then the suffering in the world, the relationship to the suffering of others. I think pretty much all my books divide along those lines.
The Poetry Salon is on a mission to provide inspiration, education, and support to poets everywhere at a price that is truly affordable for all.
Together, we are building a thriving community where poets can learn, grow, and share their work.
Whether you are a beginning poet or already a published author, you can get prompts, rewrite strategies, and a warm, supportive place where you can share your writing with other poets online.
Visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
And when I think of your poems, they definitely have those themes, but yet some poems, you know, when we talk about suffering, it's so heavy and it's so dark and there's no breath in between the pain. And I think of how I actually knew about you, besides Trisha, was the poem to the woman crying uncontrollably in the next stall. That I have the little broadside you gave me. It's hanging above my computer and I read it every day and look at it every day. And the ending of that poem, "Listen, I love you, joy is coming," is just such a human ending. And I think you do a really great job of balancing, yes, the love and the relationships and the suffering, but there is also a strong, for me, in my reading, relationship to light. Do you feel that? Or to hope, or whatever word you want to use.
Yeah. Toni Morrison once said that with dark material, you have to engineer moments of lightness. Mm. And I think every poem, you know, every dark poem needs light in it, and vice versa. And without that, you aren't really being accurate to life. Life is both light and dark. So I'm very suspicious of poems that are all dark or all light. But although sometimes just the writing of the poem is the light in the poem, in a sense. The idea of hope, I wish I could write more hopeful poems. High Desert, New Mexico, and The Woman Crying Uncontrollably in the Next Stall, those are both poems that offer solace at the end. Mm. And I really appreciate the poems that offer solace, and I wish I wrote more of them that offer that kind of solace. And I know that just expressing the darkness can be another kind of solace to someone who's going through a hard time. Mm. I am happy and pleased when I manage to write something that I feel is, you know, that everybody's going to respond to, because it is sort of that message of hope. I had a poem, or I guess it's still up there on the New York subways right now, that's an older poem of mine. But I just saw a note on Facebook by someone who said that they rode the subway, they hadn't ridden for a long time, and there was my poem, and it was just what they needed at that moment. And that made me so good to know that something you've written has gone out into the world, and you never know who it's affecting or how. And it's kind of great when something comes back to you like that and you go, oh, great, I made somebody's day just a little bit better.
Yeah. I feel so much like that sometimes is what a really great poem can do, is just be like, hey, I'm going to be here with you. I'm not going to tell you you have to be happy, and I'm not going to try to pull you out, and I'm not going to try to argue with you against what you're feeling. I'm just going to sit here and be here with you, and at least that way you don't have to be alone. And then so much of sadness is the shame we feel about how we're feeling and the feeling that we're being rejected by the world. So if the world says, you know, you're not alone in this, like, it lifts it so much.
Yeah.
So talk about the Scorpion poem and how you wrestled with that one. I honestly felt like that one must have been your easy one, because it feels like it comes so naturally. The way that the finished product looks, it looks very natural. So I'd love to know how that one came about.
So I wrote some notes down here. I went back and looked at the draft so I can give you a little taste of that. For one thing, it's important for me to find the voice of the poem, the voice of the piece. I think of that more than finding my voice. It's like, if I find the voice of an essay or a story or a poem, then I can write the piece. And this was one that it was very hard for me to find the voice. So I had a lot of iterations. If I didn't have it in the first line, I wasn't going to get the voice. Here were a couple examples of some early first lines. The actual one, as it ends up, was, "I'm not sure what to do about that scorpion twitching on the wall." More talkative, right? Less tight in that way than the other one. So some of them were, "A scorpion unmoving on the wall is easy to kill." Or, "I think I could kill that scorpion on the wall." And this was what led to a draft that wasn't anywhere near the finished one. "How to address that scorpion on the wall. Just arm yourself with a shoe and enough wine to subdue the hen that nests in your brain." You can hear the shorter lines. You can hear there's a kind of meter and rhyme starting to break through. But in that case, I didn't pursue that. And so then it went on about the hen that nests in your brain and became an argument between the hen and the rooster in my head, and a conflict about whether to kill the scorpion or not. And the hen in the brain is advocating for mercy, and the rooster in the brain is name-checking Da Vinci and Savonarola, that sort of the fanatical, pleasure-despising monk who mesmerized Florence for a while in the late 15th century and was ultimately hanged and burned at the stake.
Oh, wow.
So the hen is saying all these nice things about the tomatoes and the light, and the rooster is saying things about... And the hen's going, "Da Vinci?" And the rooster's going, "Savonarola, Mussolini." What I realized was I had to get rid of the whole hen rooster discussion that I was attached to for a long time and trying to make work. I think I needed to go through all that before I could find another direction. So part of it is you pursue something, but you know, you may need to really run that down until you get to something that's going to work. Obviously, there's no hen and no rooster in the poem as it is now. That was the hard part about writing it. And this was also a poem that I started in 2011 when I was at the castle in the poem on a writing retreat. And then I think I finally finished it like a year or two ago. So that took 7 years or something.
Oh my gosh.
But I wasn't working on it for 7 years. It was just one of those poems that had never worked out that I would go back to every once in a while and try to take another stab at.
What I really learned from your workshop and with working with you, Kim, was let's really look at what's going on in this poem. And it's okay to say, hey, here's a really good idea. Or here's a really good line. Now let's throw everything else out and just start over. I mean, at the time also, I was still such a new poet that there wasn't much good on the page in the first place. So starting over from scratch was really very useful for me. But I think so many poets are afraid of that. They're afraid about just starting over completely. And sometimes that's exactly what needs to be done.
Yeah. And then there are a lot of poems that are just meant to go away. You know, they never work out. And then so you leave them behind. And I think it's hard for people to do that because of fear. That there's a fear that, well, I've got something now, and if I get rid of this, then I'm back to zero. But on the other hand, you need something on the page to work with. So, you know, throwing it all out can be problematic. I usually try to approach it more gently now, as in, here seems to be the central idea. What about reframing around this idea? Rather than saying, well, there's only one line here that's any good. Because that's hard for someone to hear, even if that's true. Being a teacher of writing, as I know both of you guys are, there's a line between being honest and being tactful and not shutting someone down who is learning how to relate to their own writing and how to see their own writing more clearly and how not to take it personally. And so it's always a balance to try to see where someone is and try to meet them where they are. So if they're an absolute beginner, you can't really give them a hard time about, you know, you have to just sort of say, think about this, think about writing from the body a little more and being more specific, because that's something they may just not know yet. Mm. If somebody knows that, you can get a little harder on them about certain things. And then people have such different personalities, and one person just really needs a lot of loving kindness, and another person just says, go for it. You know, take lives, eviscerate me. And I don't think we want to eviscerate anyone. I don't think that's the goal. But some people have a higher tolerance for criticism than others. And as a teacher, you're trying to negotiate that balance of who the human being is behind the poem. And at the same time, treat the poem as itself and not let it get to be too much of a piece of therapy, while acknowledging that there's a person writing it and they are, you know, invested in it.
Yeah. And I think you do it very well. Just to be clear, I mean, I never felt like you were being anything less than tactful. But I think I'm also one of those poets who I do have a pretty good sense of my own ego stability, and I am pretty much game for trying anything new. But I've always felt the way I watched you work, you were always so supportive of all of the writers. But it's ironic because I know on your website, you say this is poetry, it's not therapy. I've always felt like I got almost as much therapeutic content out of working on poems with you as I did going to my therapist.
It is therapeutic to get something outside of you that was inside. I think I can't remember if that's still on my website, but I think I put it there to scare away the non-serious people who really do just want to put their work out and have it praised, which is sort of a less developed ego, you know, or a different conception of poetry. Maybe that's a fairer description. Those are the more hobbyists that I'm not interested in working with so much. You know, I want to work with people who are serious about language. That's what we're doing. And that's what I'm trying to teach them, is how to use language. So anyone who's solely focused on the content and not the language to deliver that content is not someone I'm going to be that helpful to. Someone once said that as a teacher, you serve the people you're meant to serve.
I like that
idea a lot.
I do. Yeah. One of my favorite things that you ever said to me in workshop, you're like away at a retreat, you wrote a poem, you were super excited, showed it to a poet, and you're like, what did you think of the poem? And he said, I think you're going to see things in 3 weeks that I see now. And I think that that's what makes you so marvelous as a teacher. You've taught me a deeper intuition in terms of the questions to ask the poem. What is the story of this poem, and how are these lines serving the story or serving the structure? And I wonder, we always talk every podcast about a rewriting. We usually give our listeners a prompt, like here's a rewriting technique. And I wonder if you have any techniques that you use that hone that intuition or that ask those questions, what you teach so masterfully.
Can't you see my head getting bigger on this?
It's true, though. Now you teach me how to like look it in the eye. I feel like if you ever watched Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David does that eye thing where he gets real close and like stares. I feel like that's what you've taught me to do with a poem, and I just love it.
It is sort of what I do, is, and it's the same thing I do with my own work. I look at every line and image and I go, why are you here? Are you pulling your weight? Are you here for a reason? Or are you just here because this happened? And there are definitely moments where there's an image that's just there for verisimilitude, you know, to help you feel the environment and the world. But I think in the absolutely best writing, every single word and every single rhythm is there for a reason. And of all people, I think Hemingway is a great person to study for that. I remember a professor once taking us through his short story, Cat in the Rain, and pointing out how every little decision that Hemingway made about that very short story that contributed to what the story was doing. That was a great lesson for me to see that he thought about every moment.
Yeah. I'm a little bit curious about this. I forget who it was who said they were reviewing one of your books of poems, and they're like, there's not a word out of place. There's not an extra word that doesn't need to be there and stuff. And I know one of the things that you're known for is the sonnet, the Sonatizio, that form, that structure, that almost rigidness and spareness, I'm wondering if you can speak a little to that and what has helped you gravitate towards that.
Yeah, well, the form I invented is called the Sonatizio, and I only wrote one or two of them. So it was just sort of a fun experiment, but I do love the sonnet. You know, I took a class in grad school on meter and rhyme. So I spent an entire summer thinking in iambic pentameter. There goes the train. There's the train that passes by the house. You know, anything I saw, I immediately, my mind converted it into iambic pentameter. So I was just immersed in that meter and just fell in love with the form of the sonnet. And I'm still in love with the form, although I don't write many traditionally metered and rhyme sonnets anymore. I'm a big fan of the sonnety thing that has to get in and get out quickly and say something in a short space and make something happen in a short space and have an impact. I'm fascinated in general by the short poem. And I, once or twice a year, I teach a class called The Art of the Short Poem because I love it so much. Maybe this is also just a function of getting older and having less patience for longer works, is that I'm very attracted to shorter forms right now. And also in terms of pedagogy, I've started limiting with my online classes, I limit my students now to roughly 24 lines for a poem because I found that if somebody writes a long three pager, they're probably making the same mistakes over and over. And rather than go through all that, why not have a shorter piece where you can focus on the language much more carefully? And so both as a teacher and as a writer, I'm just really attracted to short poems. And I'm always learning about just finding new short forms is fascinating. There are wonderful poems called Landes, which the women of Afghanistan write. And Poetry Magazine did a whole feature on them a few years ago when I discovered them. And I think it's still at thepoetryfoundation.org. But those are just two line poems with a little structure, little couplets. And then, yet they say so much about the world that those women are living in. And yeah, they're kind of a subversive form because women aren't supposed to be literate. And finding those kinds of forms is really interesting to me, whether it's a triolet, which is a formal 8-line poem, or a formal 14-liner like a sonnet, or Jericho Brown, who invented the duplex, which is sort of based on an amalgam of the sonnet and a blues form and uses repetition in a certain way. I love discovering these short poems and these short structures that can just be like splitting the atom where there's so much inside and it happens quickly.
Yeah, there's so much tension just inside something that appears so small, but once you explode it, the energy is huge. I'm wondering how your background in music, I mean, just the way that you're talking about this, it sounds so much like you have a sense of rhythm just built into your body and your brain, that ability to start speaking in iambics or thinking in iambics. And I'm wondering what your relationship between poetry and music is like these days.
I've just been getting back to a little music. I think part of the lockdown situation for me was just that I kind of lost interest in music. I'd been studying jazz flute and I don't know, I just stopped wanting to play. So I wrote some friends of mine, a couple of writers that I played music with going up to Port Townsend for the Central Writers Conference there. And I just wrote them and I said, hey guys, do you think we could try to play a little music on Zoom or figure something out? Because I'm not playing any music and I want to get back to it. And so we actually met last night. It was a disaster in terms of a jam. So we're still trying to figure that out. It was nice to see them and talk. And just because we were going to get together, I started playing harmonica in the past couple days and remembering what that felt like. It's another creative outlet. Usually when I'm in it, it's a place to go when I can't write. During COVID, I couldn't write and I couldn't play music. So I did a lot of binge watching. But that comes into your writing too. The stuff about the Duchess and the Knight in the Castle. Well, I'm a big fan of historical costume dramas. So lines like that probably wouldn't have come to me if I hadn't been watching whatever I was watching at the time on the BBC.
Yeah, that's so nice, again, to hear you talking about your own particular struggles. I'm fine with writing during all of this because I got nothing else to do. But then there's times where you're drained. But I still do like revising. It's fun. And Kim, I think in a lot of ways, you taught me how to have fun with it. I don't even see it so much as interrogating the poem, asking each line, why are you here? It's more like going on a date with a poem. You have some wine, you light a candle, you say, where do you see yourself in 5 years? You know, and you're getting to know it.
I guess it depends on your version of dating, huh?
My idea is, you know, a dark little torture cell with the swinging light bulb. Between the two is a good place to land too. But it's different things at different times too. And definitely when you start out, I think that fire, you know, I remember how on fire I was because I was learning so many new things and I was so excited to see all the things a poem could do. And I loved everything. And now I'm more critical of things that I read and I'm not as excited. It's just hard to find that sometimes. But there is still that beautiful excitement when you're in a kind of trance of writing and you really feel like you've got hold of something and you're following it to see where it goes. That's an amazing feeling that we want to come back to as often as possible.
I know that we're about to wrap up soon. I had one question that I wanted to ask just about The Poet's Companion and Ordinary Genius, your books on craft and instruction, and how those got started. So I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your relationship with writing nonfiction and more guidance texts for writers.
Well, the first one was written with poet Dorianne Locks, and we were friends who were also teaching together. We were doing sort of one-day weekend intensives on various topics, and I had the idea to do a book so that we didn't have to make copies all the time. And I thought, well, this will be easy. We've already got the materials. We teach the image. We've taught a class on the dark side. We've taught a class on, you know, these various things that we were teaching. I thought, well, why don't we sort of put them together in chapters? It'll be easy. That took quite a while. And then the second one, Ordinary Genius, was just mine. It was a lot of years after The Poet's Companion was written, and it's got some similarities and some differences and just some more ways that I was thinking about writing and thinking about transmitting something about how to write to other people, how to write poetry. Yeah, and Poet's Companion, you know, came out in the 90s and it's still selling, which blows my mind. Because it was really hard to get it published. We had a lot of rejections and a lot of people saying, I don't see who's going to buy this book. We knew who was going to buy it because we were teaching those people. And we knew that there were a lot of people out there who would be interested in buying this book. But we couldn't convince a publisher for a long time. In fact, it was picked up originally by University of California Press. And then a couple of academics got a hold of it and wrote a very scathing review that was basically sort of, how dare these two young women who know nothing write this book to teach others how to write poetry? And so they dropped us.
Whoa.
And we had this amazing agent who went back to Norton after we'd gotten a Kilfie from UC Press and went back to Norton and said, you know what, these writers will, you don't need to pay them any advance, because they have this money from UC Press that paid us for a Kilfie. And so basically, here's a free book, Norton, take a chance, because you're not paying the writers anything up front. And they said yes the second time.
That was a great story.
We had a great agent who wouldn't take no for an answer. And 100,000 copies later, we're all really happy with Norton, and Norton's happy with that. It's working out fine.
We all think that writers, the amazing writers and the ones who are so well known, that they're just somehow born with it. And I love being reminded that it's not just being born with it. It's the work, it's the tenacity, it's the not taking no, it's the hearing no over and over. It's the putting it in the drawer for 7 years and continuing to come back to it.
Yeah, that's it really is.
All right. Well, Kim, thank you so much for taking the time this morning to talk with us. I'm just so delighted that Kelly gets to work with you and she understands why I've been singing your praises so long. Just thank you so much for being such a fabulous mentor to me and to other poets and putting your books out there and allowing us to learn more about poetry and life through what we get to read.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I just want to say to our listeners who might not be in the Bay Area, I know that Kim teaches online. Her books are just incredible. I mean, the poetry collections and also the craft books. So there's a lot to learn from you, and I think you're generous with the way you share it with the world. So
thank you.
Remind me the title of your next book again.
Now We're Getting Somewhere.
Now We're Getting Somewhere.
Bit of an ironic title.
And when is it due out?
They said winter 2021, so I imagine February, March, but they haven't given me an exact pub date yet.
Well, once again, we've been chatting with Kim Adonizio. Thank you once more, Kim, for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, SalonCast listeners. Do you have questions you want us to ask our guests about the writing or rewriting process? Have you tried some of these rewriting strategies yourself? What new revelations did they bring?
Message us at Tricia@thepoetrysalon.com or Kelly@thepoetrysalon.com with the subject line SalonCast Listener.
Also, do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It truly helps us get heard and get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
It takes less than a minute and it's totally free.
Thanks again for being part of our community.
And remember to write on, share on.
And remember, whoever writes the worst draft wins.
Yay!